Welcome to The Tipping Point, a podcast by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. I'm your host, Katya Gumkova. In the next half hour, we'll explore one of the most pressing challenges of our time, how to tackle the climate crisis. Just imagine gigantic masses of ice melting, flooding major cities around the world. Or a slowing down of the Gulf Stream ocean current, bringing more extreme weather events into Europe. You might think these events are looming way off in the future, but on a geological timescale, these tipping points may not be that far away. But there's reason for hope. In 2015, governments of the world reached the Paris Agreement. It was a diplomatic miracle, 6 years after the failed Copenhagen Climate Summit, and it laid out important ground rules for slowing down global warming. But will the Paris Agreement actually stop the climate change? Not by itself. In order to face the climate crisis head-on, we'll have to move quickly. How can we transform our economies and societies to move forward? This is what we're going to explore in this series. In just 100 years, human ingenuity has brought us airplanes, plastics, televisions, and the internet. We're operating a space station orbiting the Earth, and remote control rovers on the surface of Mars. So isn't it pretty safe to assume that we will find engineering solutions to the climate change as well? In this episode, we'll look at ideas to geoengineer the climate with a critical eye. We will talk to an expert in the climate field about fertilizing the oceans. And we'll also talk to another scientist about sucking carbon out of the air and creating an umbrella of aerosols around planet Earth to keep the sun rays away. Our main question is, how feasible are these ideas, and what are their side effects? First, we'll talk to Neth Denyo. Neth is the Asia director of the ETC Group. ETC is an organization devoted to issues surrounding new technologies with potential impact on the world's poor and vulnerable. We reached Neth in Manila, and the first thing she explained to us was how Filipinos feel about climate change.
Climate change is actually being felt clearly in the Philippines as a whole, where I live in particular in Mindanao Island, the southern part of the Philippines. In the past few decades, there's actually more and more typhoons that enter the country, and not just more in terms of number, but more intense typhoon with more rains, which actually cause more flooding and affect communities in the coastal areas. And the Philippines is an archipelagic country comprised of more than 7,000 islands, which means that 99% of Filipinos live within 10 kilometers area from a coast. And it is these communities that actually suffer most when typhoons come. My daughter, who lives in Manila, actually just live about 300 meters from Manila Bay. And we're actually struck at how intense flooding could be every time there's a typhoon in this area. And we have experienced one of the worst drought season from the La Nina phenomenon last year, in the year before that, which has actually massively affected agricultural areas in particular, and also urban populations because of scarcity of water. So it's really a now threat. It's a threat that's already happening.
Maybe you remember the headlines. In 2013, the strongest typhoon ever hit the Philippines. This was Tropical Storm Haiyan, which the Filipinos called Yolanda. A massive typhoon swept through the eastern part of the islands and killed more than 6,000 people. In the city of Tacloban, a highly urbanized area, Yolanda devastated entire neighborhoods. It was one of the strongest tropical cyclones ever recorded. and it coincided with the 19th United Nations Climate Summit in Warsaw.
The devastation is staggering.
When Yeb Sanu, the Filipino negotiator, spoke to the international conference in Poland, he was on the verge of tears.
I struggle to find words even for the images that we see on the news coverage. And I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses. Up to this hour, I agonize, waiting for word to the fate of my very own relatives.
The damage caused by Super Typhoon Yolanda cost billions. With climate change, Filipinos are facing a lot of consequences. Stronger and more frequent typhoons and droughts, as well as rising sea levels. The Philippines are also part of the Pacific Ring of Fire. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with climate change. It's just geology. Along the Ring of Fire, a lot of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions happen. And one of them inspired researchers to reach for the skies and tackle climate change.
It was actually the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, a volcano that slept for more than 600 years and suddenly woke up in 1991 and caused this massive, supermassive volcanic eruption that affected most of planet Earth.
The giant volcano spewed huge amounts of sulfate aerosols into the sky. They reached the stratosphere and traveled around the Earth. Now, the surprising thing is that this process was actually able to cool down the temperature of the entire planet by half a degree Celsius for a couple of months. And that was exactly the temperature rise that fossil fuels had caused until the year of the eruption, in 1991. The particles in the stratosphere acted like sunshades by reflecting some of the incoming solar radiation back into space. And so Pinatubo brought back the idea of SRM, short for Solar Radiation Management. If humans could mimic what the volcano had done, could they cool down the warming planet? Today, a group of researchers calls for testing this idea. They want to experiment with a small injection of aerosols into the stratosphere. They imagine spraying the particles from airplanes or gigantic tubes held up by balloons. After all, a similar process happened in nature.
But the dark side of the eruption of Mount Pinatubo, we seldom hear. There are tons of studies that showed that the eruption of Mount Pinatubo have actually caused massive drought in sub-Saharan Africa and also a massive change in the monsoon pattern in South Asia that have caused all these cyclones and also massive weather disturbances. And all of those happened at the trail of Mount Pinatubo were actually linked to the impact of the eruption. And already computer simulations were made available around potential impacts of SRM have already shown the same narrative that it could actually cause massive droughts in sub-Saharan Africa and massive changes in rainfall patterns and monsoon patterns in South Asia.
It's unclear how our global ecosystem would react to an intentional injection of aerosols. Atmospheric chemistry is a complex field, and sulfate particles could damage the ozone layer. Even if engineers could overcome that problem, how would the impact be tested? A small-scale experiment in the stratosphere might not be able to tell us very much. Rogue scientists have tried other large-scale experiments before that could cause real and potentially adverse effects. In the case of ocean fertilization, another geoengineering method, some researchers have already gone ahead. In 2007, Neth Danio was involved in exposing an experiment in the waters around her islands.
The plan was actually to dump urea nutrients, nitrogen fertilizers, on specific parts of the Sulu Sea, which is actually in the border of Malaysia and Philippines, with the aim of promoting growth of phytoplankton. Because conceptually, a phytoplankton would actually suck out greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular, from the atmosphere and bury that in the ocean bed. So that was the concept behind ocean fertilization. And true enough, we found out that there were actually letters sent by the researchers from Australia and their partner in one university in the Philippines about the experiment, but not really revealing what the real intent was. They were actually saying that they will dump urea in an experiment to promote bloom of fisheries to be able to help local farmers to attain sustainable fishery, which is totally what is not it is.
Neth and her organization, the ETC Group, were alarmed and spread the news. The government confirmed that the attempt to experiment in the local waters was a violation of Filipino law. No environmental impact assessment had been carried out, and none of the local governments and coastal communities had been consulted. In 2008, the Convention on Biological Diversity of the United Nations met in Bonn, Germany. This was the chance for the Filipino negotiators to bring the issue to the table. The convention ended up imposing a moratorium on ocean fertilization.
So this is a clear example of experiences coming from the ground that was brought by the country that was affected in an intergovernmental forum, and that provided the basis for deliberations and a decision for the members of the United Nations to come up with a decision to protect biodiversity, the environment, and local communities on the potential impacts of this technology, in particular ocean fertilization.
Now, what exactly are the risks with this kind of ocean fertilization? The idea sounds pretty smart. But the flip side of the carbon dioxide removal concept is that it could potentially cause a bloom of toxic plankton as well, and lead to hypoxia in turn, oxygen-depleted zones in the ocean. This would mean trouble for aquatic biodiversity, marine ecosystems, and the fisher folks who rely on them. And past field experiments have shown that much of the plankton expected to bury carbon in ocean beds ended up gobbled by krill. Plus, urea production requires fossil fuels. To Neth Daniel, geoengineering ideas like this one are flawed down to a more fundamental level.
Because it is actually based on the premise that you can actually provide a technological solution to climate change, global warming. And if you will look at the roots, the root causes of climate change, much of the massive emission of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is caused by all the technological fixes that mankind, that humankind, in the past 150 years have put in as a solution to development problems. And to us, it is simply flawed to think that a technological fix will solve a problem that has been caused largely by technologies. So for us, that has to be rethought.
Any kind of geoengineering takes place in the complexity of the Earth system, a system we don't yet fully understand. Scientists are still exploring the depths of the oceans and the chemistry of our atmosphere. Creating a sunshade around the Earth will most likely create winners and losers, some who benefit from a cooler climate, and others who have to endure the side effects, such as droughts and flooding. If we fertilize the ocean with urea, we might get a bloom of toxic plankton as well. Plus, once we've started, we'd probably have to continue for centuries to come. With these implications, there are some big questions we need to ask. Who will make the decision whether we should go down the path? What kind of geoengineering should we employ, and where? And will we ever understand the system well enough to apply these methods without catastrophic side effects? Welcome back to The Tipping Point, a podcast by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. In this first episode, we're discussing the risks of two big branches of climate geoengineering. There's the so-called solar radiation management, which attempts to change how much solar energy hits the Earth. And there are strategies to reverse our emissions, so-called negative emission methods, via carbon dioxide removal. Ocean fertilization is not the only concept engineers have come up with to remove carbon from the atmosphere. We'll now consider land-based methods with our next guest, Kate Dooley. Kate is a PhD candidate at the Climate and Energy College at the University of Melbourne in Australia. Her research connects the dots between land use, forests, and climate change. The first thing we talked about was the Paris Agreement that was reached in 2015.
Yeah, well, the Paris Agreement includes very ambitious targets to limit warming to well below 2 degrees and aiming for 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, this was fantastic news in Paris. It's something that developing countries have been fighting for a long time, because warming above these levels, even 1.5 degrees, but certainly up to 2 degrees, would be catastrophic for a lot of countries. A lot of islands would be flooded already at that point. So this was a good outcome.
After years and years of climate summits, the negotiators have finally managed to agree on targets. But this brings up the question, how do we get there? Temperatures on Earth have already warmed by a full degree since pre-industrial times. Just half a degree more, and low-lying island nations in the Pacific might be lost forever. It's a huge challenge. Is reversing the trend even possible? The last report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was published before Paris, says that the targets might still be reachable. Around the world, scientists feed their knowledge on their systems and our societies into complex computer models and combine their data. The IPCC is the intergovernmental scientific body that publishes their findings. But what are the assumptions that these models are based on?
Now, what these models have actually done to make it easier to meet those climate targets is include a lot of geoengineering. And essentially what they've included is removing carbon from the atmosphere through growing plants to suck up the carbon and then capturing that carbon. It's called bioenergy with carbon capture and storage.
BECCS, or BECCS, that's the acronym researchers and policy buffs use for this method of carbon dioxide removal. The idea is that when plants are growing, they remove the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere by photosynthesis. Burning that plant to produce energy will release the carbon back into the air. But if you catch the carbon before it is dispersed, you can liquefy it and then pump and store it underground. However, there are also large downsides, and that's why BECCS has become such a controversial topic.
One of the big problems with BECCS is that this would need to be done on a massive scale in order to actually remove enough carbon from the atmosphere to reach the below 2 degree and 1.5 degree temperature targets. So this scale would require large amounts of land for the bioenergy crops, between 400 million and 1,500 million hectares of land would be needed this century. Given the current cropping land for all of our food and timber and feedstock, all of our cropping land at the moment is 1,500 million hectares, and demand for food is expected to grow over the century as population grows. That's a lot of land expected for bioenergy from BECCS.
So in the worst case, we might need as much land as our entire agriculture takes up today. That's huge. Such a demand for land has the potential to drive up food prices. It could also drive out small farmers and forest residents from their land. In many countries, we're already seeing land grabbing caused by smaller scale bioenergy production. If harvesting bioenergy causes cropland to expand and increases deforestation, this could wipe out any emissions benefits. It would also increase poverty and undermine food security, which are key elements of the Sustainable Development Goals agreed on by the United Nations in 2015.
But it's been very well documented that right now, the use of bioenergy in the European Union is increasing the harvesting rate of forests in the southwest United States. So this is because most of the bioenergy feedstock being used in the EU is being shipped in from the US, so there's emissions associated there, but it's actually radically increased the turnover and harvest rate of those Californian forests, and people in that area are very upset and protesting about the increased harvesting of forests in the US for bioenergy in the EU. So this will continue and is expected to expand greatly into other countries because the European Union doesn't have the forest resource to supply the amount of bioenergy it's using now or expected to use in the future if trends continue.
You probably know about the important role forests play in the climate system. Think of the Amazon as our planet's lung, breathing in carbon dioxide and breathing out oxygen. If forests are lost and replaced by bioenergy crops or monocultures, it threatens biodiversity as well. Currently, we're losing species at a rate many times higher than in the past. It's an issue connected to, and as serious as, climate change itself. With deforestation, several million people could lose their homes and indigenous livelihoods. But the competition for land between the BECCS industry and food production could become one of the biggest issues. However, there are still many researchers who think carbon capture and storage could be a viable solution, and much better than such creepy-sounding ideas as, for example, solar radiation management.
It is often called like the more radical, the more dangerous form of geoengineering, or in reverse, carbon dioxide removal is called the more benign form of geoengineering. And I really think that carbon dioxide removal, which relies on land, carries a lot of risks, and we shouldn't consider it a benign form of geoengineering.
In her research, Kate Dooley has looked into ways that forests themselves can become one of the most important solutions to climate change.
There is research showing that the extent of degraded forests now in the tropics, if that was left alone and left to regrow, that would remove significant amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere this century. And it would negate the need for technologies like BECCS, which focus on land that would otherwise be used for food and other purposes. So as well as leaving aside land for food, it also means that we restore biodiversity, we restore forest lands, which are home of indigenous peoples, etc. So it's a solution that has a lot more co-benefits and a lot less risks.
The first thing we'd need to do, of course, would be to get off fossil fuels. But in many scenarios, it looks like there's also no way around carbon dioxide removal technologies such as BECCS. The crucial part you have to know here is that such scenarios include economic assumptions. And one of them is that we need to keep up economic growth, which means we cannot go down with our emissions very quickly, just a few percent a year. In fact, we would have to decrease them by something like 2 or 3 times as much to avoid potential catastrophic warming. But how true is it that we can't reduce emissions quicker? Are there alternative ways to reach the Paris targets?
These targets could be achievable without geoengineering, but it would require radical emission reductions starting immediately. In the richer developed countries, we would need to reduce emissions as rapidly as possible to zero, so probably within 15 years, which would mean significant lifestyle changes. So it would require regulation and government policy and oversight to do this, but it would mean that citizens would need to be willing to make radical lifestyle changes, such as not flying, traveling a lot less, smaller houses, less consumption, diet changes would be a big part of that, reduced meat intake, etc. So people need to be willing to make those lifestyle changes.
Our deep dive into the concepts of geoengineering leads us back to an inconvenient truth. Maybe what we need is not more uncertain and potentially risky technology, but a new approach to the challenges we face. And this includes profoundly rethinking our societies, economies, and lifestyles. From this perspective, geoengineering technologies might be just another strategy for us to avoid facing this truth.
The real risk that I see with geoengineering is that if we continue burning fossil fuels and releasing CO2 into the atmosphere now, even over the next 5 to 10 years, because we assume that we can remove these emissions later in the century, if that doesn't work out, and there's a whole host of reasons why BECCS might not actually prove feasible, particularly at the scale that we're assuming, then by then it will be too late to change course and to take a more radical emissions reduction pathway. We will be stuck with those emissions in the atmosphere, and it's likely that that would promote different kinds of geoengineering that are potentially even more dangerous. So at this stage, I think the real threat of geoengineering is that it obscures the urgency of the climate crisis and that we delay action because we assume that we'll have these technologies that will work in the future.
We don't know very much about the consequences of geoengineering methods yet, but we do know that, potentially, they might have serious side effects. And even more importantly, we know that no kind of geoengineering will be able to tackle the root and cause of the climate issue. Whether to test or even deploy geoengineering approaches is a question that will come up again and again as our planetary crisis becomes more urgent. This is why Nath Daniel calls for more transparency and participation.
Information and involvement of stakeholders. Like, you cannot expect a sound and good governance if you don't provide objective information, not just to governments, but to potentially affected communities. And definitely, no one can expect intelligent decisions if there are no information and involvement in the first place. Right now, geoengineering is being discussed in limited places, particularly in industrial countries, in academic communities, when you're actually talking about implementation, experimentation, deployment, and implications that would involve the rest of the world, particularly developing countries. And right now, there's very low awareness on the part of governments, much less on the part of communities on geoengineering as a whole, when it is already being discussed as part of the solution to climate change. And to us, that's actually the zero step that should define the way forward for geoengineering.
We're at a tipping point in our climate as well as our societies. It's up to us to tip our world into the right direction and tackle the climate crisis head on. My name is Katya Kumkova. Thanks for listening to our podcast. You can find all the episodes at boell.de/tippingpoint. Audio from Yeb Senyo is courtesy of the IISD Earth Negotiations Bulletin. The music for this episode comes from Crinkles and is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Only license. In our next episode, we'll be looking at climate justice and ask, can the court solve the climate crisis? Until then, bye-bye.